This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents Little Altars Everywhere, written by Rebecca Wells and performed by Judith Ivy. To Thomas Schwor, my beloved, Thomas Wells, my brother, TG, my guide, and Lodi, my home soil. Everything in life that we really accept undergoes a change. So suffering must become love. That is the mystery. Catherine Mansfield. Note to the listener. I've been thinking lately about the intimacy that exists between us, writer and reader. And the more I reflect, the more grateful I am for this gift, because the process of a book's coming to life is not fully complete until your imagination meets mine on the page. The words evoke pictures, and something altogether new is created, something different from the limits of my own skills and imagination, something that is a marriage between your heart, mind, and body, and mine. Although inspiration is assumed to be essential to art, in fact, all life requires inspiration. Inspiration, literally, to breathe in. To breathe in the life-giving oxygen we need, and also to breathe in whatever divine breath our bodies can receive. When you enter the world of a book I have written, our breaths intermingle, along with whatever celestial breeze might bless our exchange. Breathing in, breathing out. In so doing, if we are lucky or blessed, it all comes to life. The whole idea of possessing creative work is perhaps as absurd as the ownership of rivers and trees. Helpers and co-conspirators meet me at every turn. I'm graced with all sorts of comfort and aid from my motley crew of angels, spirits born and unborn, people near and far, trees, dahlias, the smell of gumbo on the back burner, my cocker spaniel, Lulu, my husband who is sent straight from the Holy Land as a gift to me, making up for all that is wobbly, wrecked, or lost. Once you, the reader, encounter the words on the page, the alphabet has meaning. So my work also becomes yours. My closest friends have been known to call me Rebecca It Takes a Village Wells. They know firsthand what it takes to write a book, at least for me. I never claim to be a low-maintenance gal, but when I'm writing, it's particularly challenging. I lose things constantly, my watch, my glasses, my papers, my mind. The image of a writer as a solitary person who does it all alone is an illusion, or perhaps a delusion. Too little has been written about the contributions of a writer's loved ones, especially partners, in the creation of a book. Their sight, their touch, their ears, their belief, their patience. The food they hand out to put into mouths when we have forgotten food was necessary. Those we love, those who love us, contribute to our work in ways too countless, too precious to explain. Little Altars Everywhere began as a single short story. I based Looking for My Mules on a tale told to me by a person I love dearly. I was working as a playwright and actor while I was writing the story. "You're no writer," sneered the inner critic who tries to sabotage my every move. "You're just a theater person. Who do you think you're kidding?" I wrote Looking for My Mules anyway, and a blessed small literary magazine picked it up, giving me a boost in confidence that I desperately needed. Slowly, over many years, other chapters began to grow. Then, while performing a burlesque dance in my play, Gloria Duplex, wearing 4-inch spike heels, I came out of a flying dismount, landed off balance, and broke a tiny bone in my left foot called the sesamoid. Small as this bone is, it serves a crucial purpose. It acts for the foot as the knee does for the leg. It hurt to walk. It hurt to stand. It hurt to sleep with a heavy blanket covering my feet. It hurt too much to be on stage. I was sidelined until my foot healed, which took more time than I can bear to think about, even now. I had worked for years to get where I was, and this was devastating to me as a professional actor. You can't afford to be out of the loop. You must be seen. You can't turn down role after role and still expect them to call. It was scary, depressing, and lonely to lose the career I had trained for and nurtured my entire life in one way or the other. That broken bone forced me to quiet down, sit still, and write. Something I've always had trouble doing, because the actor body I inhabit longs to stay in constant motion. Hidden blessings inside suffering. This is ultimately what Little Altars Everywhere is about. We are given our lives, our fear, our broken bones, and broken hearts. Breaks create openings that were not there before, and in that space grow the seeds for new creation. So that at the dark center of suffering that suffuses Little Altars Everywhere lies both the luminance of blessing as well as the seeds for my second book, Divine Secrets of the Yaya Sisterhood. Little Altars Everywhere was originally published by a tiny Northwest press. They gave me the biggest gift anyone could have, the perfect editor for the manuscript, Mary Helen Clark. We met every Saturday morning at my home on the island, consuming gallons of coffee and tea and baskets of yummies from the local bakery. We stretched out on my bed with drafts of chapters covering every square inch and howled with laughter over bits we thought were funny. Then we tried to come up with something even funnier, the sadness we did not have to work on. It came, as sadness usually does, as soon as I sat down and began to listen. The small press had a correspondingly small budget for publicity, so my husband, our best friend, and I became a public relations firm and did our damnedest to promote the book. We made up a letterhead on our Mac, maxed out our credit cards at the copy shop, and hit the local and regional media for all we were worth. I'd make follow-up calls to radio and TV and newspapers, pretending to be a secretary, just following up on the Rebecca Wells material we sent you. I have given thanks for my background as an actor more than once. Receiving the Western States Book Award for Little Altars Everywhere brought some money into the coffers of the small press and helped the book along, not to mention giving me a surge of optimism. Then booksellers began their big-hearted word-of-mouth campaign to sell my book, and I learned to love booksellers as much as I had always loved librarians, book friends, too many to count. With the publication of Divine Secrets of the Yaya Sisterhood, Little Altars Everywhere was reissued in paperback, and now, to my great joy, in hardcover. People ask me how I feel, and I say, happy. Or more accurately, I say, a big, fat, beautiful gift has dropped into my lap, and I hope I know how to treat it right. I continue to be awestruck and honored by the generosity readers have shown me in sharing their feelings about my books, especially the gift of extraordinary and heartfelt letters. The wisdom and goodwill of the 83-year-old woman in a tiny town in Minnesota who wrote me to say, "At first I was not going to get your book because the title was so strange, but one of my favorite books also has a strange title. So I read yours, then I gave it to all four of my daughters. You keep going. I'm going to write Oprah and tell her about your books." I received this letter when my book had sold approximately 27 copies. Or the man in Olympia, Washington, who wrote to me with the exact words I craved as the books began selling. "In case you ever wonder if your success is deserved, as humans often do, my vote says it is." I do not know if this reader will ever know how his response tapped into a deep fear in me, acknowledged it, and then comforted me. For whether he is right or wrong, whether we deserve anything, he reminded me that I am part of a beloved community that stretches out farther than I can see. This has been the greatest blessing of having my books read widely, the knowledge that I am not so alone, that I am not as orphaned as I once feared. How can a person ask for more than that? Then there's the joy of meeting readers face to face. I've met people who have changed my life forever, sometimes simply by the inscription that they asked me to pen into their copy of my book. I've met people who know so much more than I do, and they continue to tell me what it is that I have written. Because when you're writing, you are not fully aware of what you are writing. You have no answers. In fact, you're lucky if you can remember the questions. Readers find clues, and if you're fortunate, they share them with you. We are worked on by the work we are helped to create. Compassion works on us. Acceptance works on us. If we can see past the myopic confines of the ego that aggressively believes that it alone is responsible for each act of creativity, nay, for life itself, then it is possible to recognize the bounteous goodness and generosity that pours into the making of your fiction as well as your life. All creativity is a gift. All life is a gift. And what a fetching ecosystem it is. I am given a gift. I am helped to hand it on to you, reader, in the form of a book. As you read, you keep the gift moving, and then hand a new gift back to me, the gift of having been met, of having been seen, of having been listened to. And so I thank you for holding this book in your hands. My heart's wish is that we both will see what Sitta does when she swings high on the backyard swing, that holy sparks do fly everywhere, especially between writers and readers. Rebecca Wells, September 1998. Oh, my soul. Sitta Lee, 1991. In my dream, I'm 5 years old again, and it's a summer night at our camp at Spring Creek. Mama and all us kids, me, little Shep, Baylor, and Lulu, around a bonfire. Mama's gang of girlfriends, the Yayas, and all their kids are there too. Mama goes inside and puts little Richard on the record player. She cranks the music up so loud it bounces off the pine trees. Then she comes back, takes my hand, and says, "All right now, Sitta Lee, dance." Oh, my soul! Little Richard begins, shouting out a warning for the weak of heart. And Mama's already shaking. She's boogieing. She's juking. She's slapping her thighs and rolling her hips like I've never seen her do before. "Baby, baby, 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 don't you know my love is true? Ooh, honey, 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 get up off of that money." That man sings nasty. Those horns blow nasty. My body takes over and I'm moving. Sunburned legs shuffle across the ground. Head rolls around. I turn in circles. I face Mama and shake my shoulders and hips faster than the human eye can see. I shake so hard that freckles jump off my face. "Baby, baby, 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 don't you know my love is true? Ooh, honey, 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 get up off of that money." My hair flies in my face. It flies in my mouth. Mama stomps the earth with her feet. I can see her rich girl red painted toenails against the dirt. I laugh. I spin. I almost stumble over the other kids. But when I do, they help me back up. And I keep on dancing. Richard, little Richard, he's shining like a shooting star. He's the hottest thing in the Louisiana night sky. He hollers right up into my 4-foot frame. He wails and horns blow. Oh, those horns blow. Love, 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 love. Oh, my soul. Arms and legs have new lives all their own. every single part of me dances, and that 45 RPM record plays over and over and over, and we're singing with Little Richard now, we're blowing saxophones, and if Daddy drives up in his pickup, you know he'd yell at us, white women dancing like that, you know he would. But Daddy doesn't drive up, and me and Mama go on dancing, and all the ya-yas and the rest of the kids are yelling and clapping for us. Oh, they yell and clap and hoot and holler. And I know, you can't tell me different, something secret, something sweet, something strong is shooting up from the earth straight into my body, making my limbs quiver, making me crazy dance all over the place, right there in my orange and white sunsuit. When I wake up from my dream, I'm laughing, and my face is streaked with tears. My body feels relaxed, loose, good. And for a minute, I swear I feel Mama in the room. Feel her Jergens lotioned hands touching mine, the way they used to when I was little, and she'd say, "Come here, darling, I've rubbed on way too much. Let me give you some moisturizer." I roll over in bed, and I'm 33 years older than in my dream, and I still want to hold Mama's hands. I'm crying and I'm laughing, and I still want my mother to come to me and take me in her arms. Part 1. Wilderness Training, Siddeley, 1963. One thing I really hate about Girl Scouts is those uniforms. They bring out my worst features, fat arms and short legs. Mama tries her best to give that drab green getup some style, but I just get sent home with a note because the glitzy pieces of costume jewelry she pins on me are against regulations. The only reason I joined Scouts in the first place was all because of merit badges. I wanted to earn more of those things than any other girl in Central Louisiana. I wanted my sash to be so heavy with badges that it would sag off my shoulder when I walked. There wouldn't be any doubt about how outstanding I was. When I walked past the mothers waiting in their station wagons outside the parish hall, I wanted them to shake their heads in amazement. I wanted them to mutter, "I just don't know how in the world the child does it. That Siddeley Walker is such a superior Girl Scout." I love going over and over the checklists for earning those badges in the Girl Scout handbook. I have 8 badges, more than Melaine Chauvin, who constantly tries to beat me in every single thing. I have got to keep my eye on that girl. She is one of my best friends, and we compete in everything from music lessons to telephone manners. I was making real progress with my badges, and then our Girl Scout troop leader up and quit right after the Christmas holidays. She said she could no longer handle the stress of scouting. She didn't even tell us herself, just sent a note to the Girl Scout bigwigs, and they canceled our meetings until they could find someone to take us on. And wouldn't you know it, out of the wild blue, Mama and Niecy Ogden decide to take things over and lead our troop. I could not believe my ears. Mama and Niecy have been best friends since age 5. Along with Caro and Teensy, they make up the Yayas. The Yayas drink bourbon and branch water and go shopping together. All day long, every Thursday, they play bourre, which is a kind of cutthroat Louisiana poker. When you get the right cards, you yell out bourre real loud, slam your cards down on the table, then go fix another drink. The Yayas had all their kids at just about the same time, but then Niecy kept going and had some more. Their idol is Tallulah Bankhead, and they call everyone darling, just like she did. Their favorite singer is Judy Garland or Barbara Streisand, depending on their moods. The Yayas all love to sing. Also, the Yayas were briefly arrested for something they did when they were in high school, but Mama won't tell me what it was because she says, "I'm too young to comprehend." At least Niecy goes out and gets herself a Girl Scout leader's outfit. Mama will not let anything remotely resembling a Scout leader uniform touch her skin. She says those things are manufactured by Old Hag International. She says if they insist on keeping those hideous uniforms, then they should change the name from Girl Scouts to Neuter Scouts. Mama drew up some sketches of new designs for Girl Scout uniforms that she said were far more flattering than the old ones, but none of the Scout bigwigs would listen to her. So, instead, she shows up at every meeting wearing her famous orange stretch pants and those huge monster sweaters. The first official act of Mama and Niecy's reign is to completely scrap merit badges, because Mama says they make us look like military midgets. Whenever I gripe about being cut off just as I was about to earn my advanced cooking badge, Mama says, "Zip it, kiddo. Don't ever admit you know a thing about cooking, or it'll be used against you in later life." Now, at our meetings, instead of working on our hospitality, music, and sewing badges, they have us work on dramatic readings. They make us memorize James Whitcomb Riley and Carl Sandburg poems, and then Mama coaches us on how to recite them. She calls out, "Enunciate, darling. Feel it. Feel it. Love those words out into the air." All my popular girlfriends look at me like, "Oh, we never knew you came from a nut house." I just lie and tell them Mama used to be a Broadway actress, when all she ever really did in New York was model hats for a year, until she got lonely enough to come home and marry Daddy. Our annual Scout campout always comes up just after Easter. I just dread it. I'm in the middle of reading a truly inspiring book called Judy's Journey. It's all about this girl who's exactly my age, and she and her whole family are migrant workers. They have to travel from place to place, living hand to mouth. Judy works in the fields and never complains, and she is brave and a hard worker and very popular with all the other migrant kids. Her father plays the harmonica, and her mother is so kind and quiet. I fantasize around 50 times a day about being her instead of me. I would just kill to stay in my room and finish that book instead of going on a stupid camp out. But you got to do these things whether you want to or not. Otherwise, any chance you have at popularity can go straight down the drain and you will never get it back. You have to start early if you plan to be popular. Mama was extremely popular when she was growing up. She was elected most well-liked. She was head cheerleader, captain of the girls' tennis team, and assistant editor of the yearbook. Everyone at Thornton High knew who she was. Even though it sometimes wore her out, she said hi to every single soul she passed in the hall. It was a lot of work, but that is how her reputation was built. Mama understands the gospel of popularity, and she is passing it on to me, so I won't be left out on the fringes. We head out to Camp Mary Alice real early on a Saturday morning. It is 20 or so miles from Thornton in the deep piney woods. They named the camp for this very famous Louisiana Girl Scout who gave up her entire life for scouting. There is a main lodge built of logs with a huge fireplace at one end, long tables set up in the middle, and a big kitchen at the other end. Not far away, at the edge of the woods, there is a screened-in cabin filled with bunk beds where you sleep. Right off the bat, Niecy backs her country squire station wagon into the flagpole and bends it in half. I'm inside the cabin unfurling my bedroll when I hear this big uproar. I bolt out the door, and wouldn't you know it, there is the Girl Scout flag flapping in the breeze a couple of inches above the ground. The Louisiana state flag with the mama pelican feeding her babies is right next to it, and the American flag is right next to that. Mama is laying on the ground, kicking her feet up and down, just howling with laughter. "Tootie," she yells, "quit it. I'm TTing all over myself." Tootie is Niecy's Yaya nickname, and all the scouts flutter around me, squealing, "Sitta, why is your mother calling Mrs. Ogden Tootie? Why is your mother wetting her pants?" Well, I could have predicted that something like this was going to happen. You can't go anywhere with Mama without things getting nuts. If it's going along too smooth, she will invent something just to stir things up. Sometimes we'll be downtown shopping, and everything's going normal, and Mama will put her fingers in her mouth and let out the loudest, most piercing whistle you ever heard in your life. Then everyone gets startled and drops what they're doing and looks around to see where the noise came from. And Mama, she'll just bend over and pretend to be looking at a pair of shoes. Then she'll lift her head and look around, acting like she's just as puzzled as everyone else. But later, once she gets us in the car, she'll laugh her head off, saying, "Did y'all see how I shook up those old fuddy-duddies?" And that is only one of her tricks. Niecy sits in the car, hooting her head off, too, and finally Mama pulls herself up off the ground and goes over to Niecy, walking like Red Skelton. She says, "Good going, darling, done like a true yaw-yaw." Niecy says, "Vivi, when in the hell did they put a flagpole there?" And they both crack up again, and Mama lights them each a cigarette. I stand off to the side behind one of the big loblolly pines, hoping Mama can't spot me, but she yells out, "Sitta, darling, go get me my file out of my purse. I think I've broken a fingernail." Great, I think, just great. This is going to be a perfect campout with my perfect mother, who I wish would shrivel up and blow away. Then I say a quick prayer so I won't burn in hell for having such thoughts about my own mother. It can wear you to a nub trying to be a popular person and a good Catholic all at the same time. There is no way in the world she can pull this off. It's one thing for her to act half normal in an hour meeting at the parish hall on Wednesday afternoons, but trying to act sane and sober for a whole weekend is a whole different ball of wax. So what do our great leaders do? They just walk away from that station wagon and that bent flagpole like nothing ever happened and lead us off on the big hike. Now, I just hate hikes because they always get me out of breath. Plus, I would rather simply look at the great outdoors than actually be in it. But I step along as quick as I can to keep up with Melaine and Sissy with their ladybug shirts tucked into their pants. They've both got these neat walking sticks that they found, and their hair is done up in dog ears, and everything about them is clip-clip. You've got to understand the social structure of Troop 55. There are, 1, the popular girls, Melaine and Sissy, and maybe Mimi Plowshay, and me, if I do things right on a lucky day. 2, the almost popular girls. They try real hard, but never quite make it. For instance, their leader is Rena Litz, whose father is the manager of the very first Kmart in central Louisiana. She dresses in brand new clothes all the time, but they're cheap, cheap, cheap. And she has an accent from Ohio that sounds like she always has a stuffed-up nose. 3, the unpopular girls. At least they love each other. And 4, Edith Spivey. Edith Spivey is in a class all by herself. She has kind of a crow face with pimples around her big old honker nose and hair so oily that Melaine says you could wax the floor with her head. Oily hair is the worst thing you can have at Our Lady of Divine Compassion parochial school. If you have oily hair, you might as well just lie down and die and get it over with. And, just to top things off, old Edith wears cheap, pointy eyeglasses and crinkled-up shoes. She looks like an orphan, even though we know she has this fat mother who takes in sewing. In fact, just last Christmas, Edith's mother made her this special holiday dress of green felt that was designed to look exactly like a Christmas tree. Edith wore it to a Catholic youth organization party, and the thing actually had little balls dangling off of it, and every time she bent over to pick up the ones that fell off, you could see her underwear. Now, a true Catholic would try to be kind to Edith, but I just can't. It's too dangerous. You could get lumped in with her, and then maybe even become her, and end up living in a trailer the rest of your life watching Dialing for Dollars. Anyway, we're hiking along like little marching rats, and Mama has on her white sun hat and sunglasses, and she's holding the Super 8 like she's shooting a movie in Hollywood. She adores that Super 8 and won't let anyone touch it but her. She films all of us walking through the piney woods and yells out, "Y'all do something! This is a movie camera!" You can smell the sun hitting the needles and see little mushrooms under your feet. If you quit thinking about everybody and everything, it gets real quiet and private, like swimming underwater with your eyes open. I stop for a minute to feel some bark peeling off a pine like it's the tree's skin, and then I look up and suddenly realize that Edith has almost caught up with me. She says, "Fiddle-lee, did you see that monarch butterfly?" I wouldn't mind seeing a monarch, but I panic at the thought of being left behind with Edith. I act like I don't hear her and take off running to the front of the group where my popular friends are. The sprint gets me winded, and I have to pretend I'm coughing and palm my asthma inhaler to stop the wheezing. I pray, "God, please don't let me get stuck with Edith, and please don't let Malaine see me sucking on this inhaler like Daddy." Then Mama says, "Okay, y'all, we're gonna sing now." And she starts up with her old camp songs that only the Yah-Yahs and their kids know the words to. I wish I could crawl off and hide from her voice and her legs, marching like she is the general of the world. She sings, "I go with the garbage man's daughter, Slop Slop. She lives down by the swill. She is as sweet as the garbage itself, and her breath is sweeter still, Slop Slop." Ah, she just makes me so sick. Who does she think she is, Mitch Miller? I signal to Malaine and Sissy that my mother drives me crazy. I've got to let them know that I am not like her. But then, don't you know it, they start trying to sing along with her, stumbling over the words, acting like they've sung it 100 times when they've never heard it before in their lives. Mama keeps leading the big sing-along, and we march through the woods like in The Bridge on the River Kwai. Finally, I start singing too, all loud and full-throated. Mama always says, "If you can't sing it good, Siddeley, at least sing it loud." By the time we stop to cook our food, I'm dizzy from all that hiking and singing. We have to dig out these little pits in the ground and drop hot coals in there, and then plunk our tinfoil packets full of potatoes and vegetables and hamburger meat down in there and let it all cook together. It takes forever, and you get dirt under your fingernails, and I just hate it. Mama acts like she's an Indian princess in the great outdoors, but I notice that she's got her these little packets of peanut butter crackers that she unwraps and eats, and a Coke that she slips out of her knapsack and gulps down. My throat is all dry, and it's too dusty out here. I don't see how my daddy can stand it, working in the fields all day long. When we finally finish up eating and head back to camp, Malaine whispers to Sissy and Mimi and me, "Y'all watch Edith. Look at how she walks." And we stare at Edith the whole way back. She walks all bunched up, like invisible hands are squeezing her shoulders together. It gets me embarrassed just to look at her.
I want to go over and hit her on the back and say, Edith, walk right. Quit being such an I don't know what. Back at Camp Mary Alice, Mama and Niecy get out the Hershey bars and jumbo marshmallows and graham crackers, and we make s'mores. I've got to have my marshmallows done perfectly light brown all the way around, or I will not eat them. I don't see how anybody can stand to swallow the burnt-up ones. After I get mine just perfect, I slip it off my coat hanger right on top of the Hershey bar. I bite into that crunchy cracker and taste that marshmallow and chocolate down to the tip of my toes. Mama says, y'all keep rotating those marshmallows constantly, and they will roast evenly. When anybody's, even Edith's, marshmallow falls off into the dirt, Mama laughs and hands them another one. One thing about Mama, she is never stingy with food. This is the fun part. Around the campfire, those flames lick up into the black sky, and you can see the stars so good. Mama does what she does best, tell stories. She acts out scary stories, like the one about the old maid sisters in the big house on Evangeline Street right in Thornton who got eaten to death by giant ants. All their skin got chewed off, and the only thing left was their bones and shoes. Mama says, I saw it with my own eyes when I was about y'all's age. Isn't that true, Niecy? Niecy nods her head and says, it's the gospel truth. Melaine whispers to me, you can tell your mama was a New York actress. That makes me feel the best I've felt all day. I walk by Mama's side on the way back to the cabin and hold her hand for a minute. Mama and Niecy rig up sheets all around their bunks so they can get some privacy. We take sponge baths and put on our nightgowns, and then we're supposed to go to sleep. Melaine and Sissy and Mimi and I all have our hair rolled up on spoolies, because who knows what kind of things might pop up the next day that will make demands on our hairdos. My legs are twitching, they're so tired. But in that cabin with all the other girls, far away from home, and the smell of the pines and the shadows on the screens, well, you couldn't go straight to sleep for $1 million. All the lights are out except a nightlight that Mama has plugged in at our end of the cabin and a little lamp that lights up Mama and Niecy behind the sheets like they're shadow puppets. Moonlight shines down through the trees, and you can hear the frogs croaking and the 10,000 crickets hopping around our cabin like Mexican jumping beans. I put my head down on the pillow and close my eyes, but then I get that second wind that makes you punchy and giggly and bad. Melaine hits me with her pillow, and I'm up in a flash, wonking her over the head, and then Sissy joins in, and Mimi, and we're whacking each other and laughing and screaming and jumping on the beds. I start tickling Sissy, which always gets her going, and she's yelling, stop, please, really, please, stop, just like I do when my brother, Little Shepherd Daddy, tickles me. Cigarette smoke drifts up out of Mama and Niecy's cubbyhole, and you can barely hear a Texas late-night station playing Fats Domino on Mama's transistor radio. Mimi says, I know a nasty joke. Y'all want to hear? Her joke is all about this man who gets his thing stuck in a hole in the floor, and I laugh and laugh, even though I don't think it's all that funny. I have seen both of my brother's things, and they look like turkey necks to me. Like if you're not careful, they could get slammed in a door and fall right off on the floor. It's one of the reasons I'm glad I'm a girl, with everything tucked up inside, where things can't get at it so easy. The almost popular girls are playing Go Fish with Girl Scout playing cards. The unpopular girls are reading their own individual books, which for a minute makes me wish I was one of them so I could lay up and finish Judy's journey. Edith just sits on her bed with her hands in her lap and stares at me. I cannot believe it. She is wearing a house coat and slippers like a little old lady, and an actual hairnet like a cafeteria server. Why is she looking at me? I am not the ringleader over here in the popular group. I am barely here myself. I wish she would turn her beady eyes away and stare at someone else. Melaine and Mimi are playing cat's cradle, and me and Sissy start pretending we're Gidget in the dorm at college. Then do you know what happens? Edith gets up and walks right over to us on Melaine's bed and just stands there. I can see the way her veins are all purple on her hands. Her face is all red in spots, like she has been picking at it. Why doesn't she say anything? She just stands there looking at me like she's waiting for something. Finally, I say, Edith, what do you want? I think, oh, God, what if she asked to sit on the bed and play with us? But she says, it is time to go to sleep now. It's way past our curfew. Y'all are breaking the Girl Scouts of America rules. Well, that just cracks us all up. And Melaine says, hey, Edith, why don't you go on back to your bed and pick your zits? Then Mimi says, yeah, but don't aim in our direction. Edith looks at me like I'm responsible for the whole world. Then she turns and pads back to her bed and keeps on staring at me. If she doesn't quit doing that, I'm either going to lose my mind or have to get up and clobber her. We start singing 99 Bottles of Beer on the Wall, which is an extremely stupid song, but that's how it is when you're in a group. We get all the way down to 68 bottles, and then here comes Edith again. And she puts it all to me again, like I am the ambassador to the popular girls, which I definitely am not. She says, Thiddly, I'm giving y'all one more chance. If y'all don't go to sleep right now, I'm going to tell your mother. God, why can't she leave me alone? Edith Spivey has been tailing me around since first grade. Just because one single time I smiled at her at the water fountain, she has tried to leech on to me for life. What does she think she is, my shadow or something? Does she think we are blood sisters for life? I would like to reach out and touch the cuff of that awful bathrobe and tell her, just relax, Edie. Everything's okay. To show her she's not really as cootified as we treat her. But Melaine and Sissy and Mimi are watching me, waiting to see what I'll do. I know they'll banish me forever if I am nice to Edith. I know how close I am to being kicked off the popular bunk for life. I've spent a lot of time trying to have a good personality, and I will not let Edith ruin everything now. Hey, Edith, I finally say, why don't you go on back to your bunk and eat your boogers for a midnight snack like you always do at home? Well, that comment really sends my friends, and I'm a big hit. But then I see Edith's face. It's like something has fallen on it and crumpled it in. Somehow she looks so familiar that I can feel her bones inside my own body, and I start to feel sort of sick. She turns and walks away, and Melaine says, 10 points, Sitta, 10 points. Why don't you just shut up, Melaine, I say. Then I laugh like I didn't really mean it. Edith walks the full length of the cabin to Mama and Niecy's cubbyhole. She isn't kidding. She's going to tell on us. If she tells Mama what I said to her, Mama will jerk my arm out of its socket right on the spot. One thing Mama will not stand for is deliberate cruelty. Deliberate cruelty is the reason I got belt-whipped last Thanksgiving and couldn't go to dance class for 2 weeks because of the marks on my legs. I tiptoe to the edge of the cubbyhole. My bare feet are cold against the plank floors. I can feel goosebumps on my arms. I pull back one of the sheets just a hair so I can see inside. They're up on the top bunk smoking. Mama is polishing her toenails. I can see the name on the bottle, Rich Girl Red. Edith is looking up at my mother. She says, Mrs. Walker, the 9 o'clock curfew is a national Girl Scout rule. It is almost 12 o'clock midnight now. Y'all should make them go to sleep and turn out your light, too. The blue thermos with Mama's vodka and grapefruit juice sits on the bedspread between her and Niecy.
I can smell that nail polish in the clean, cool air of the woods. The minute Mama opens her mouth, I realize she's had at least 4 drinks. Her voice is loose and deep and content and amused, and she says, "Edith, don't you ever tell me what to do again as long as you live. Now get your little goody-two-shoes butt back into your bunk before I spank the hell out of you." Then Mama starts laughing. She sticks a piece of cotton between her toes so the polish won't smear. Edith does not move. "Honestly, Edith," Mama says, like she's going to give her the most important advice in the world, "if you continue acting this way, you will be unpopular for the rest of your life." I wish I could go someplace far away from the heart of Louisiana, but I just walk back to Mullane's bunk and tell them what just happened. And they all laugh like hyenas. Mimi says, "Boy, your mother sure is cool, Siddeley." Edith comes back and climbs into her bed without saying a word. I can see the oyster-colored skin of her arms where they stick out of her old lady bathrobe. I think about getting up and going to her, saying something, doing something, climbing in the bed with her and just breathing with her. I almost do it, too. I almost comfort Edith, but the sight of her hairnet just stops me cold. Edith doesn't make a peep the rest of the weekend. It rains all day Sunday, and even when the unpopular girls ask her to sit with them in the lodge, she says no. She just sits by the window and stares out into the woods like something real interesting might happen out there. That next meeting, all of Troop 55 presents Mama and Niecy with a thank you collage. Mama lets Niecy take it home. She says, "Niecy, I'm sure you have a better place of honor in your home to display this piece of fine art." At the end of the school year, the two of them volunteer to lead us for another year, but the Central Louisiana Girl Scout bigwigs tell Mama and Niecy they already have a more experienced person lined up. They say Mama and Niecy deviated from the Girl Scout program, and that it set a bad example for girls our age to see a flagpole get bent up like that. They say that it bordered on being unpatriotic. One day after school is out, Mama is sitting on the window seat in the den looking at the bayou, meditating, she calls it. I bring her a Coke with crushed ice without her even asking, and she puts her hand on my cheek and kind of cups it there like she used to when I was little. I tell her, "I'm quitting Scouts next year, Mama. They're jealous of you. That's why they didn't beg you to stay on. The Girl Scouts of America aren't ready for someone like you." Mama twists my hair and holds it up off my neck. She studies me, then drops my hair and turns away. "I don't know, darling," she sighs. "Sometimes it's hard to tell what vocation I'm cut out for. Sometimes it's just real hard to tell." Sometime during the summer, I have this dream about Edith Spivey and me. We're on the swing that hangs from the pecan tree in our backyard. And while we're swinging, it's like Edith's body is in my body. Her legs kick out from my legs, and her head leans forward out of mine. When I move my arms forward, hers come out of them. We are swinging in this just right rhythm. We are swinging high, flying way up, higher than in real life. And when I look down, I see all the ordinary stuff. Our brick house, the porch, the tool shed, the back windows, the oil drum barbecue pit, the clothesline, the chinaberry tree. But they are all lit up from inside, so their everyday selves have holy sparks in them. And if people could only see those sparks, they'd go and kneel in front of them and pray and just feel good. Somehow the whole world looks like little altars everywhere. And every time Edith and me fly up into the air and then dive down to earth, it's like we're bowing our heads at those altars, and we are praying and playing all at the same time. We just keep swinging and swinging, and in my dream, we are swinging at the center of the most popular spot in the world. Choreography, Sid Lee, 1961. I have fallen in love with my dance teacher. I mean, I really love her. Her name is Charlene Parks, and she came back to Thornton to live with her mama after being a June Taylor dancer on the Jackie Gleason show. She is tall and slender and pretty, and she used to be Miss Louisiana 1954 before she went off to New York City to be famous. Her long chestnut hair is always up in a dancer's ponytail, and she has thick eyelashes, and her body is perfect. No bumps on it, or hair in weird places, or anything. The way she moves, it's like her legs are hooked on different at the hip than other ladies' legs are. Charlene's Central Louisiana School of the Dance is in a big old cave-like dance studio at the Garnett Parish Community Center. I take tap lessons from her twice a week, and I adore it. Only I get to take tap, not Lulu, not Little Shep, not Baylor, just me. That dance studio is hot as hell in the summer, even though two huge industrial-sized fans blow like crazy all the time. Mirrors line the walls, and ballet bars run the length of the room. The floor is smooth, and there's a table at one end with Charlene's record player and piles of popular records and show tunes. At the start of each class, Charlene performs a dazzling showstopper, while we sit on the floor with our mouths hanging open, pulling at our leotards, which are always crawling up our crotches. What I wish I knew is how real dancers on stage keep from having to pull at their crotches all the time. As hot and sweaty as it gets in there, Charlene always looks fresh. She dances in high-heeled tap shoes, and I think they are the jazziest things in the world. I would give anything for a pair of my own, but we only get to wear low heels. Charlene uses a lot of George M. Cohan music because it's easy for us to count out, but we also learn numbers to High Hopes and Itsy Bitsy Teeny Weeny Yellow Polka Dot Bikini, a song that my grandmother Buggy turns off whenever it comes on the radio because she says it's a sin for such impurity to be on the airwaves. Charlene's record player has a little knob on the side of it so she can slow the music down to a crawl for us to get the rhythm, while she calls out, hop, shuffle, slap, or whatever the step is. Once we start to catch on, she brings the music real slow-like back up to speed, and we try to actually put the steps to time. That always throws me. Just when I think I have the steps down, the music speeds up, and I forget everything I've learned. I try and try, but I never can dance fast enough and still get it right. But Charlene never fusses, she never pushes, she gives a lot of praise, and I work hard so I can be exactly like her. My riffs and toe tips and touches are always a little off, though. I just cannot seem to make my left foot cooperate with my right one. It's like there are two separate people on the different sides of my body. I've worshipped Charlene for months, and I have prayed to God for her to notice me. And finally, I get to be her pet, which is the best thing I could hope for in this whole town. This is how lucky I am. Charlene lets me visit her at her mother's house on St. Gerard Street. They live in a big pink stucco Spanish house, the only one like it in the city of Thornton. Charlene's room is the closest you can get to Hollywood without leaving Louisiana. It has a round bed that her mother ordered from Dallas. It's covered with a pink satin comforter, and dozens of little pink and green satin pillows are thrown all over the place. These heavy pink and green flowered curtains hang over all the windows so they can block out the morning sun. Even so, Charlene sleeps with a sleep mask on to block out whatever sunlight peeks through. On the days when I get to visit Charlene's, I wake up at 6 a.m., but Mama won't take me over there until after 9. And then Charlene is still asleep. I can't believe she sleeps so long. I have to sit in the kitchen with their maid, Jewel, and wait and wait and wait. Then, when Jewel says it's time, she lets me trail along while she brings Charlene her cafe au lait in bed. When we get to the edge of the bed, Jewel lets me hold the coffee tray. Charlene turns over, and I'm standing there looking at her, making sure I don't spill a drop. I say, "Rise and shine, Miss Sleepyhead," like Mama does. Jewel walks over to the curtains, and then Charlene always says, "Oh, Jewel, will you please just sneak those drapes open real slow-like?" And Jewel pulls those curtains open little by little, keeping an eye on Charlene to make sure she isn't doing it too fast. Jewel told me one time that there was too much light for Miss Charlene in New York, and that was why she had to come back home. Jewel said she was not fixing to add any more to Miss Charlene's heartache if she could help it. Finally, Charlene sits up and lifts that sleep mask up off her eyes and uses it like a headband to push back her hair. I have been begging Mama for weeks to buy me a sleep mask, but she says, "Absolutely not. You're too damn dramatic as it is." Then Charlene looks over at me and smiles her big, lazy, just waking up smile and asks me, "Want to climb in, sitter?" I hand her the coffee milk and let myself up on the bed very gently so I won't disturb her. The air conditioner is always pumped up to high all night long, so it is freezing in that room. Charlene pulls the comforter up over me and says, like it's something tragic, "Oh, Santa, you've got goosebumps." Then Jewel goes over to Charlene's big console stereo and says, "Miss Charlene, what tune do you want to start your day with?" And Charlene says, "Oh, I don't know, Jewel. Why don't you ask our guest?" And I blurt out, "South Pacific. No, play Carousel. Yeah, Carousel. Let's listen to Julie Jordan." Charlene yawns and starts humming, and when Jewel has the volume just right, Charlene says, "Jewel, how come you're so good to me?" Every single time, Jewel says back, "'Cause your mama gonna take care of Jewel in her old age." Everything in that world is pure heaven. I just get lightheaded with all the attention I get from Charlene. But then I start to worry that she'll notice how dumb I am and not like me anymore. I just have to hold myself back from dancing and singing and turning backflips to show Charlene what a fantastic child I am so she will love me forever. Then my Aunt Jessie comes home from college for the summer. She moves into her old room at my Grandma Buggy's house, and immediately she starts making fun of everything Buggy does. When Buggy tells me it's time to wash my hair, Aunt Jessie will say, "Mother, the word is wash, not wash. And while we're at it, the word is rinse, not wrench. Say it, Mother, wash and rinse." And Buggy repeats it after Aunt Jessie, but then she goes right back to her old ways of talking. Aunt Jessie also thinks Buggy's shoulders are too rounded. She will go over and slap her hand between my grandmother's shoulder blades, and Buggy will stand perfectly straight for a minute. And Aunt Jessie will turn around and say to us, "There, doesn't Buggy look less countrified?" It is thrilling to have Aunt Jessie home because she lets me show her all my dance routines. Mama never wants to hear anything about my lessons. When I try to show her Charlene's numbers from the pajama game, Mama just says, "God, I'll be relieved when you get off this Charlene Parks jag." One time me and Mama got in this gigantic fight because she wouldn't let me wear the rhinestone tiara that Charlene sent me home with because I was queen for the week. All of Charlene's students get to take turns being queen, and it is a very big deal. But Mama said, "That tiara is the tackiest little thing I've ever laid my eyes on. You will not wear that piece of trash on your head." Well, I am not about to let anything connected with Charlene get criticized, so I said, "Mama, you're just jealous because you can't dance like Charlene." Mama said, "Shut your filthy mouth." Then I said, "Shut your filthy mouth," which was not like me to say, but I just was not about to let Mama put down Charlene right in front of me. Even though it meant I couldn't go to dance class for a week because of the marks on my legs where Mama hit me with Daddy's cowboy belt, I simply had to defend Charlene. Aunt Jessie just wants to hear everything. When I get back from class, I show all my routines to her. If she has the record, she'll stand me in front of her full-length mirror and teach me to sing the words to the dance tunes. Of course, Aunt Jessie already knows about Charlene being ex-Miss Louisiana, but I am the one to tell her about the Jackie Gleason show. I am also the one who tells her about Charlene's sleep mask and her pink comforter and her little dotted Swiss baby doll pajamas. When she's home for the summer, Aunt Jessie and I always do lots of fun things. Sometimes she'll decide at 10 o'clock at night that she absolutely has to have a root beer float, and we jump into Buggy's Ford Fairlane and put on over to the A&W wearing nothing but our cotton PK nightgowns. We order from the car hop, and Aunt Jessie just dares anybody to say a word about how we're dressed. And we ride horses early in the mornings before the sun gets scorching hot. Aunt Jessie is a great horsewoman. She teaches me dressage and grooming and how to feel what a horse is saying to you. She says, "You've always got to be the boss. Once you let the horse take over, then you just might as well forget the whole thing." One time after dance class, Aunt Jessie comes to pick me up as a surprise. Instead of waiting in the car like Mama does, she walks right up to the door of the dance studio. We are just finishing up our Yankee Doodle Dandy routine with all the slaps and toe tips, and from the corner of my eye, I can see Aunt Jessie leaning against the door in her khaki pants and loafers with no socks. I pretend I don't notice her, but I start kicking and hopping furiously to impress her with my talent. As soon as we finish, I run over to Aunt Jessie and grab her hand. I'm panting like a dog. I'm so out of breath. I say, "Come on, come and meet Charlene." I pull her over to the record player where Charlene is putting stuff away. Charlene looks especially gorgeous. She has on her black leotard with a pink sash around the waist and a matching scarf in her hair. Just the way she stands with her feet kind of splayed out is a wonder to me. I try to stand like that so people will think I'm a professional dancer, but Mama always comes along and says, "Stop standing duck-footed. You look ridiculous." I say, "Charlene, this is my Aunt Jessie. She goes to Ole Miss." Aunt Jessie says, "Thrilled to finally meet. The child adores you." Then she holds out her hand to shake hands with Charlene, although ladies in Thornton never do that. It doesn't faze Charlene, though. She's probably seen everything in New York. She shakes Aunt Jessie's hand, and they look each other right in the eyes. "Good to meet you," Charlene says, and she reaches her other hand up to touch her hair. Then she does a tendu and smiles. Aunt Jessie says, "I want to thank you for the special attention you've been giving Siddle Lee. She's my protege, you know." I chime in, "Aunt Jessie teaches me how to sing."
"Oh, do you sing?"
Charlene asks Aunt Jessie. Aunt Jessie laughs and says, I sing passionately to horses, dogs, and children. The general public I avoid. Charlene laughs back, and Aunt Jessie says, I've enjoyed seeing you on television. How lucky we are to have you back in Thornton. Charlene does a plie and says, It's nice to be back, I think. Aunt Jessie is the one smiling now, and she says, Maybe we should get together sometime and have a laugh or two about this armpit of a town. Charlene says, I'd like that. God knows there's enough to laugh about. I want to ask, there is? Then I think, Are y'all going to laugh about me? But before I can even